from Ground Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now!
My name is Jennifer Harbury. I'm here with a number of friends from Latin America. All of us will be commenting today on our efforts to curb governmental abuses of human rights and to bring the perpetrators of those violations to justice.
Putting war criminals on trial, a conversation with Judge Baltazar Garzón, Jennifer Harbury, and Joyce Horman, three pioneers in the struggle to bring war criminals to justice. A Venezuelan Congressional Truth Commission has been investigating claims of a vast conspiracy to topple President Hugo Chavez, and also looking into the role of the United States. Today we'll talk to some Venezuelan government officials. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy Goodman is en route to East Timor, and please join us next week on Monday when she begins a two-week special series, From Annihilation to a New Nation, East Timor is Born. Some of the headlines today. The Israeli army's siege at Bethlehem's Church of the Nativity is drawing to a close. A British military plane carrying 13 so-called Palestinian militants into exile landed in Cyprus today. Cyprus has agreed to take the men temporarily. 26 other alleged militants have been transferred to Palestinian Authority custody in Gaza. Earlier today, 10 international activists were forcibly removed from the Church of the Nativity by Israeli forces. They have been taken to an unknown destination. They were refusing to leave the church until they were promised not to be arrested or deported. Israeli tanks, meanwhile, are massing on the border of the Gaza Strip as Israel has called up military reservists. An invasion of Gaza would be in response to the most recent suicide bombings. And Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said yesterday any operation will be, quote, focused. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting a dispute has broken out within the Israeli army about the operation. Senior officers are worrying an invasion of Gaza will break public support for the army. One senior official said, tanks going into Gaza will leave a lot of damage even if we don't mean to do so. If they tell us to go, we'll follow orders, but that won't reduce our questions about the wisdom of those orders. Gaza is one of the most densely populated places in the world. Over a million people live on some 150 square miles, many in impoverished refugee camps. Meanwhile, Israeli officers have detained four Jews on suspicion of planning mass terror attacks against Palestinian residents in East Jerusalem. The U.S. is asking Arab allies to press Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to start a political reform process which would culminate in a Palestinian constitution, new political institutions, and possibly a prime minister. An Israeli official claimed President Bush and Sharon agreed in a meeting this week that Arafat would be eased out of power into a symbolic position. President Bush yesterday denied the accusation. Meanwhile, a new poll conducted by the University of Maryland has found almost 60% of Americans blame Israelis and Palestinians equally for the breakdown of the peace process and the ongoing violence. Over half the respondents favored restricting U.S. military aid to Israel, something Bush has refused to discuss, and over 60% said they supported Bush's call last month for Israel to withdraw. The Program on International Policy Attitudes interviewed over 800 randomly selected people last week. British Marines have discovered over 100 truckloads of tanks, artillery, and anti-aircraft guns in an Afghan mountain complex of caves. They were serviced and primed for immediate use, leading to suspicion that the fighters were preparing for an attack. Here at home, Maryland Governor Paris Glendening yesterday declared a moratorium on executions. Glendening says he is concerned the death penalty process in Maryland and across the country is racist. Glendening faced the prospect of executing five men, four of them blacks, who had killed whites over the next few months. Glendening declared a moratorium until a study of racism in murder prosecutions is released in September and reviewed by the General Assembly. The House passed the biggest increase in military spending in decades early today. The bill calls for $383 billion for the Pentagon in 2003, about $4 billion more than President Bush had requested. Among the items being funded is research into nuclear-tipped missiles, major exemptions for the Pentagon from environmental laws, money for the Crusader mobile artillery cannon the Pentagon doesn't want. The Army favors continued development of the Crusader and is backed by influential lawmakers, but Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld calls the weapon outmoded and says he intends to cancel it. The White House Budget Office yesterday promised to recommend a veto if the defense authorization bill required funding for the Crusader. And in this note, the U.S. has partially suspended aid for Colombia's war on drugs after a, quote, significant amount of money destined for the anti-narcotics police disappeared. The head of Colombia's anti-narcotics police confirmed an investigation is underway and said six officers have been fired. And those are some of the headlines for today.
I lost one sister and two brothers.
It was 10 days before I was to give birth. The army was shooting people, and they would die at our feet, but you couldn't stop to help them.
I know families that were totally wiped out.
East Timor, annihilation to a new nation. Tune in to Democracy Now!, beginning May 13th, broadcasting from East Timor.
Converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire on the people.
Well, we pride ourselves, and I think properly so, in standing up for human rights.
Military assistance programs expose the trainees to democratic ideas and humanitarian standards.
I'm very concerned about what's happened in East Timor. We have ignored it so far in ways that I think are unconscionable.
I was informed by Colonel Sugianto, he was a top officer in the Jakarta administration, that America had given the green light for Indonesia to invade Timor.
From East Timor, this is Democracy Now!
From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! Tomorrow is the one-month anniversary, the failed coup in Venezuela, but we'll be getting to that in a short period of time. The Bush administration this week took the unprecedented step of signing the treaty of setting up the world's first permanent war crimes, of unsigning the treaty, setting up the world's first permanent war crimes tribunal. But the march for justice for the victims of crimes against humanity continues. It continues in the International Criminal Court that will be established on July 1, in spite of the United States. And it goes on in the numerous specific cases that have been brought against murderous dictators and governments. It is these cases that have created the legal space in which to establish an international criminal court. In one of the most famous landmark cases, Spanish judge Baltasar Garzón charged Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet with numerous human rights crimes and ordered him arrested in 1998 in England. Pinochet had for years eluded responsibility for the deaths, disappearances, and tortures of thousands of Chileans. Pinochet remained under house arrest for 16 months while the British debated his fate. In the end, English officials decided Pinochet could not be extradited to Spain because of his ill health and allowed him to return to Chile. But once in Chile, officials stripped Pinochet of his immunity, opening the door for his prosecution there. There are now more than 100 cases pending in Chile against Pinochet. Today, we'll talk with Judge Garzón, who is in New York City for a special conference Historical Memory Conference, and we will not be able to talk about any of the particular cases that he presides over, but we'd like to welcome him here so that he can talk to us in general about some of the key issues of human rights worldwide that he has been involved in. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Judge Garzón. Bienvenido a nuestro programa.
Gracias. Buenos días.
I would like to start by asking you, how is it that Spain can decide cases about criminals from other countries, for those listeners around this nation who don't understand that? Quisiera preguntarle al principio, ¿cómo es que España puede juzgar estos casos que pasaron en otros países?
Sí. En España existe una ley que prevé la posibilidad de juzgar crímenes de genocidio, de torturas y de terrorismo internacional, aplicando el principio de justicia penal universal o de persecución universal.
In Spain, there exists a law that allows us to try criminals convicted or accused of genocide, torture, and crimes against humanity under universal jurisdiction.
Se trata de delitos que atacan a la comunidad internacional, delitos internacionales, y es una norma contra la impunidad.
It has to do with crimes attacking general crimes that attack humanity, and it has to do with again your universal jurisdiction.
And in your legal system, in the United States, usually it is prosecutors who bring indictments, not judges, and judges try them. How does the system work in Spain? En los Estados Unidos es un fiscal que trae al principio el caso, no un juez. El juez es el que oye el juicio. ¿Me puede explicar cómo es que funciona en España?
Sí. En España existe el juez de instrucción, que es el encargado de investigar, y juez de instrucción soy yo, y posteriormente existen tres jueces diferentes que son los encargados de enjuiciar y en su caso condenar o absolver.
In Spain, judges have the capacity to investigate crimes, and in order to prosecute the crimes or to analyze the cases, there are three different types of judges that preside.
And you initially, some years ago, also sought to get investigation on what is known in Latin America as the Dirty War in Argentina. Could you tell some of our listeners about that war, if not necessarily about the principles involved that you sought to indict? Usted hace unos cuantos años trató de traer a la justicia algunos de los que estaban envueltos en la guerra sucia, lo que se llama en América Latina, especialmente en Argentina. Sin hablar de los casos en particular, si nos puede hablar un poco en términos de qué fue la guerra sucia y qué fue su impacto en Argentina y América Latina.
Bueno, en realidad constituye toda una época en América Latina en la que desde el poder se desarrollaron actividades violentas, masivamente violentas, contra ciudadanos, contra clases de personas, por su simple adscripción ideológica y también por su pertenencia a determinadas etnias, como por ejemplo la etnia maya en Guatemala. Fue un sistema de terror desde el Estado, hecho sistemáticamente, y que integra, desde luego, la categoría de crímenes contra la humanidad y delitos de genocidio.
In Latin America, this occurred during an era where state-sanctioned or state-sponsored terrorism was unleashed upon the population. It consisted of massive acts of violence against people for ideological reasons as well as for ethnic reasons, such as the attacks against the Mayans in Guatemala.
Quizás la característica más importante es que, de alguna forma, todo ello obedecía a un sistema coordinado de represión ideológica en diferentes países de Latinoamérica, obedeciendo a una misma doctrina común de lucha contra el comunismo, aunque realmente bajo esa excusa se ampararon una pura y simple represión sistemática con torturas, desaparición forzada de personas y asesinatos.
What's characteristic of this reign of terror is that it occurred in multiple countries in Latin America, and it was a state-sanctioned, repressive, ideologically repressive time. Generally, the argument was that they were fighting against communism. That was the excuse of the state at the time, and this led to widespread torture, forced detention, and forced disappearances.
Y la característica común ha sido también normalmente la de la impunidad.
And another characteristic has generally been of impunity. They have not been brought to justice.
Well, I'd like to ask you, in terms of impunity, some information that you've sought in recent times has been over the U.S. Involvement in U.S. governmental involvement in some of these cases, as in Chile, for instance, and you've sought some information even from the former Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. What's been the response of the U.S. government? And not only you, but another judge in Spain has also sought information from the U.S. government about Operation Condor in Latin America. What's been the response of the U.S. government to these, to you and the other Spanish judge who have sought that information? En tiempo reciente, usted ha tratado de buscar, pedir información del gobierno de los Estados Unidos acerca de su papel en muchos de estos acontecimientos y estas guerras sucias en América Latina, incluyendo a Chile y hasta el que era este secretario de Estado, Henry Kissinger. Quisiera saber, y no solamente usted, pero otro juez también en España, yo sé, ha tratado de buscar esta información. ¿Nos puede decir qué ha sido la respuesta del gobierno de los Estados Unidos en términos de su atentado de conseguir estos informes?
Desgraciadamente no puedo hablar de los casos concretos porque todavía en España se tramita este procedimiento. Sí le puedo decir que hubo una petición de ayuda internacional a través de una comisión rogatoria. Esa comisión rogatoria todavía está pendiente de contestar en parte. Es cierto que se suministraron distintos documentos desclasificados de diferentes servicios y agencias de los Estados Unidos, y todavía está en tramitación la respuesta en otros aspectos que no puedo detallar por la reserva legal que como juez necesariamente tengo.
Unfortunately, I can't discuss the actual cases as they are still pending in Spain. We have made an international petition to declassify documents that the United States currently holds, and we are waiting for the response. Unfortunately, I can't go into further detail because of my role as an investigator in the case.
Esos datos se refieren esencialmente a lo que se conoció en su día como el operativo Cóndor.
That information relates directly to what it was known as Operation Condor.
In terms of your upfront role in much of this, how has the Spanish government, which today is basically a much more conservative government than in the past, responded to your attempts to bring some of these international criminals to justice? Reconociendo que hoy en España hay un gobierno más conservador que en el pasado, ¿qué ha sido la respuesta de su gobierno a sus labores en términos de tratar de traer algunos de estos criminales internacionales a la justicia?
Afortunadamente en España existe la independencia del Poder Judicial respecto de los otros poderes del Estado, y es una independencia real. Por tanto, la actividad del gobierno en este caso ha sido nula, es decir, no ha interferido la acción judicial, sin perjuicio de que dentro de los trámites de la extradición hay un papel que juegan los gobiernos, las autoridades políticas, y en el caso del senador Augusto Pinochet la ejercieron decidiendo la devolución a Chile. Pero debe quedar claro que la extradición se ganó, es decir, el juez inglés Ronald Bartle decidió favorablemente a la petición española.
Fortunately, in Spain, the judiciary works independently from the state, which means that the government has not interfered in any of the activities that the judiciary has handled. The state does play a role, as was seen in the Pinochet case, returning Pinochet back to Chile, but thankfully we do have judicial independence.
Well, I think what we're going to take a break right now for stations to identify themselves. And when we return, we're speaking with Judge Baltasar Garzón of Spain. When we return, we'll also be joined by Jennifer Harberry and Joyce Horman, and we'll continue the conversation. You're listening to Democracy Now!
This is his right hand, he takes an oath. turns up some fields, and above all the sound of the screams of the innocent beneath the wheels.
Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. We're continuing our conversation with Judge Baltasar Garzón of Spain. And we're also joined now by Jennifer Harberry, a human rights lawyer and wife of slain Guatemalan rebel leader Efraín Bamaca Velázquez. She's the author of Searching for Everando, about her quest to find out the truth about her husband's disappearance. And we're also joined by Joyce Horman, widow of journalist, human rights activist Charles Horman, who was killed in Chile in 1973, just days before the coup ousting the Chilean leader Salvador Allende. Horman sued Henry Kissinger in 1997 for $4.9 million and information on the murder of her husband. Over time, bits and pieces have come out, and the picture emerged of an ugly conspiracy to silence her husband for his knowledge of the U.S. involvement in the ambush killing of constitutionalist General René Schneider. As told in 1980 film Missing, Horman had only recently completed his research into the U.S. role in Schneider's killing when he was kidnapped off the streets in front of neighbors on September 17th, 1973. And welcome to both of you who've been here several times before on Democracy Now! And I'd like to first start, though, with asking Judge Garzón a question that's on the minds of many Americans. Is your response to the decision of the Bush administration to unsign or reject the signing of the International Criminal Court Treaty? Quisiera preguntarle, ¿qué piensa usted acerca de la decisión del gobierno del presidente Bush de rehusar participar en la Corte Internacional como había decidido el gobierno del presidente Clinton?
Me parece un error histórico por parte de la administración norteamericana el haber levantado la firma del Estatuto de Roma. Sin duda, la Corte Penal Internacional es la mayor iniciativa de paz que ha existido en los tiempos recientes. Una iniciativa de paz desde la legalidad, que no desde la guerra, y en la que se muestra la solidaridad de todos y cada uno de los países a los que precisamente Estados Unidos reclamó a la hora de combatir los ataques terroristas. Y precisamente ahora es cuando, necesitando los demás de ese apoyo solidario para, bajo los principios de igualdad y de independencia y legalidad, se sume a la Corte Penal Internacional, Estados Unidos decide lo contrario.
The decision of the United States to unsign the statute of the ICC is a historic error. By signing the statute, the United States is obligated to participate in establishing peace and bringing an end to terrorist activities. Having unsigned the Rome Statute takes away from that initiative. The ICC is the biggest peace initiative in modern times, which requires international solidarity. And this is exactly what we need from the United States, particularly with this current threat of terrorism activities.
Bueno, you are here as well with Jennifer Harberry and Joyce Horman to participate in a historic conference, the Historical Memory Conference. And I'd like to ask Jennifer Harberry what the conference is about and what you hope will emerge from it.
Well, the conference will be documenting a number of the campaigns of genocide that were carried out within Guatemala throughout the 80s and continuing into the 90s, of course, and will also track very crucial efforts on the international front to curb human rights violations carried out by government officials, both within Guatemala, for example, within other countries, and also as backed by the United States officials. Certainly in my case, there were heavy implications of CIA involvement very directly. So it's our hope to discuss the legal procedures that can be carried out, the legal mechanisms at our disposal, where we should go as an international campaign, not again just for Guatemala, but internationally with other countries that have suffered similar dirty wars, and again to document and remember those who were killed.
But in places like Guatemala, we learned yesterday, for instance, that many of the generals and leaders who were responsible for the genocide are still in power. And in fact, that Rigoberta Menchú has been seeking in Spain to bring some of them to justice for their crimes. What is your sense of what's going on in Guatemala right today?
Well, as you just said, I would certainly be in agreement that the military dictators and military officials who masterminded and carried out the campaign of genocide and terror against the Mayan citizens, as documented in the United Nations Truth Commission report, those people are still in power. Riels Montt, who was certainly one of the number one perpetrators of the massacre campaign in the early 80s, in which there were village by village massacres of 300 people in an afternoon, for example, remains head of the Congress. The problem remains, and the terror remains. People are still being killed. A head administrator of Rigoberta Menchú's office was assassinated only a few days ago in broad daylight. That's what our conference will be about today. We're going to discuss these ongoing problems, who the governmental perpetrators are, what we should be doing on a political front, and perhaps most importantly, what we should be doing on a juridical front. What can we do through the international legal mechanisms at our disposal today? And I'm here to both talk and to learn.
And Joyce Horman, you were beginning to have some progress in the previous Clinton administration, at least in being able to get some of the documents of the U.S. involvement in the events in Chile so long ago, and in the murder of your husband, and now there's a new administration and not quite predisposed to bearing those secrets and finding out what was Henry Kissinger's role back then. What's going to be your message to the people in the conference today, and in terms of the new situation politically in this country?
Well, I think that first I want to just correct a couple of things from the start. My husband was taken forcibly from his home after the coup by Pinochet forces and taken directly to the National Stadium, which had been changed into a detention center where he was tortured and killed, as many others were. Now, when we came home from Chile after finding out he'd been killed, the U.S. government, as much as and they knew differently, but the voice person said Charles Horman was killed in the streets by leftists, and they knew differently. They knew that he'd been killed, taken to the stadium. So there, in that particular situation, we did not find that the U.S. Government was standing up, number one, to protect a U.S. citizen, and number two, to help uncover who murdered a U.S. citizen in another country. That was the most indicative behavior. We didn't go to court against Kissinger in 1976 until a Chilean intelligence officer told us that he was in the room when Charles had been killed, or Charles had, when it was decided that he had to disappear because he knew too much, and that there was an American in the room as well. That impelled us to court. That was a civil case against Henry Kissinger and other members of the State Department for information regarding my husband's death, which we felt they had. That case was dismissed without prejudice, which meant that the judge acknowledged that there was more information. The information or the documents that we got at that time through the Freedom of Information Act were very redacted, very blotted out. We didn't get any information. 20 years later, because of Clinton's mandated declassification, which I think came about because of some of the requests from the Spanish government and Judge Garzón, the declassification of those documents produced one document, really, of new information that showed us that back then, 20 years ago, the then State Department agreed with us that the case had to be investigated because it looked like U.S. intelligence agents had an unfortunate role in the death of my husband. So we were, of course, overjoyed when Pinochet was arrested, and we were hoping for that case to go to trial in Spain. It didn't work out that way. He went back to Chile. His senatorial immunity was stripped, as Judge Garzón pointed out, which was a boon to so many people who then filed cases with Judge Guzman in Chile, 300 people. There were 300 cases, and we decided to file because of the limited amount of information we'd gotten from the declassified documents. So we've been in case in Chile. We've been in court in Chile for the last year. I've been down there four times. But the Chilean lawyers we are researching more information about the National Stadium and how it was constructed, and that pertains not only to our case but to other cases, Chilean cases, in court now. That research is important. Also, the litigation has been consolidated a little bit by the Chilean system that has provided more human rights judges. which is very helpful. And Judge Guzman has retained six cases, sort of consolidated cases, and ours is one of them, and we're very grateful for that. We're still really in court about this, and it's unfinished business. Now, our case is a criminal case against Pinochet in Chile, and it's got witnesses, primary witness is Henry Kissinger. And so our lawyers have filed letters rogatory, which is an international process of sending questions across borders in legal cases. And that's part of what has resulted from the international impact of the decision to send the arrest warrant from Spain, from Judge Garzón, to Britain, which they then honored and arrested him for 16 months. This process has been unfolding, and rather quickly, I think, for all the judicial systems all over the world, and it's a wonderful thing, and I'm very honored to be here today with these two people.
Well, one of the things that your husband's case has brought to the surface and the work of Judge Garzón in Spain is this phenomena called Operation Condor that most Americans have very little knowledge about. Would either of you like to comment about Operation Condor and what its effect on Latin America?
I would like to just make a point about Pinochet's crossing borders to assassinate his political opponents. Orlando Letelier was car bombed in Washington, and an American was killed there. So his was really state-sponsored terrorism, and our government was friendly to that. You know, Kissinger was in the documents, it came out that, you know, he went to visit Pinochet and he said, you know, look, the OAS, we're going to talk about some human rights abuses, but don't worry too much. We have to do that in order to get congressional support for some of the things we want to do for you. So there was a collaboration with state-sponsored terrorism, and I think that's the really important part about that epoch in Chile and the U.S. involvement there. Of course, the Operation Condor, some of the details, which I don't have right at the fingertips, but of course that was supporting the transport of prisoners across borders for purposes of human rights crimes. And the U.S. was participating and supporting that, and that's what the other thing that the documents are bringing out or brought out over the last couple of years.
And Jennifer, in terms of what you are hoping, is there anything in terms of your husband's case that is still to be resolved in the years to come in terms of our government?
I would say quite a few. The case has split into two cases, basically. We are finishing up now an international case out of the Inter-American Court of the OAS in San Jose, Costa Rica, against the Guatemalan military, and just received the reparations decision following closely upon the original sentencia, finding that the Guatemalan military did capture my husband alive, tortured him for well over a year, if not 2 years, in secret detention, covered up his death, obstructed justice, shot at me, shot at my attorneys, et cetera, et cetera. And they are now ordered to pay reparations, and also, most importantly to me, to return his body within 6 months. So I expect, frankly, more bullets to fly very soon in Guatemala. Perhaps most importantly to me, as a United States citizen, given the direct participation of both State Department officials and also directly the CIA officials at the branch station in Guatemala in paying my husband's torturers and covering up for 2 years the fact that they knew he was in secret detention, being tortured by our own employees while I was trying to save his life, thus preventing me from going to a U.S. court and getting emergency orders to save his life and that of the other 350 secret prisoners that the CIA informed the State Department were in fact being detained and tortured as well. Given that, I'm most interested in seeing what the United States Supreme Court will do to my access to courts claim that they just heard. I'm hoping very much that the United States juridical system will be able to handle these issues, but we have to wait and see what the court rules.
And in terms of the lack of information of most Americans about any of these atrocities, how do you think that can be remedied?
Given the I'm sorry.
In this country, the lack of information that the American people have about many of these human rights violations in Latin America and other parts of the world, besides the conference that you're holding, what other things could be done to remedy that situation?
Well, the most important thing, and I'm sure that Joyce would agree with me and also the judge, is that our declassification procedures under the Freedom of Information Act should not be shut down, as Mr. Ashcroft is now trying to do. They should be opened broadly. As long as abuses of power and corruption and criminal violations occur and can be covered up, then our government is going to become much weakened instead of strengthened, and our judicial system is going to be completely sidestepped, as it has been all along. That information has to be broadly disclosed so that Congress can handle the violations that it's informed about and carry out appropriate reforms. That's certainly number one. And number two, we certainly owe people like you a great debt in getting the information to the public. Certainly this station is one of the very few that's ever been willing to really air all of the facts in these kinds of cases. So thank you.
Well, and just, may I just say one more thing to that, too. Next week, we're going to be celebrating 20 years of the movie Missing. And I think that was a very breakthrough movie in terms of raising consciousness globally about the human rights crimes that occurred in not only Chile, but all over Latin America. And I think that this kind of artist's participation in communicating the personal details and losses of human rights crimes is very important to the victims and the victims' families.
And I'd like to ask Judge Garcon one last question. Speaking of this issue of the government covering up what it's doing in some of it, what about, you've been very critical of the U.S. government role in terms of those held in Guantanamo without charge and related to the U.S. war on terrorism. Could you talk a little bit about that? Usted en el pasado criticó el gobierno de los Estados Unidos por su papel en mantener los presos que tiene en Guantánamo en su guerra contra el terrorismo sin montarle cargos de ninguna forma. ¿Nos puede hablar un poco de eso?
Bueno, se refiere, creo, a un artículo publicado sobre los aspectos relacionados con las detenciones de ciudadanos talibán o afganos o de diferentes nacionalidades en Guantánamo y las detenciones de personas sin identificar en diferentes puntos de Estados Unidos. Desde mi punto de vista, la indefinición legal en la que se encuentran o se encontraban estas personas contribuye a una violación de los derechos esenciales que cualquier detenido debe tener si optamos por una calificación de delito de terrorismo o, en todo caso, también cualquier persona a que se encuentra privada de libertad por una acción de guerra, como aparentemente se había titulado. En todo caso, sí.
You're referring to the Afghan citizens who are currently held in Guantanamo, as well as other non-identified citizens there. These individuals currently have their rights violated despite the accusations of terrorist activities.
En todo caso, lo que yo he criticado y sigo criticando es el aumento demasiado peligroso de los llamados espacios sin derecho, es decir, bolsas de desprotección de los ciudadanos sometidos a proceso y las consecuencias posteriores que ello puede tener ante una eventual cooperación internacional jurídica en que puede haber problemas respecto de las pruebas, respecto de la no prestación de esos derechos que todo ciudadano tiene, el derecho de defensa, el derecho de comunicación, la obtención lícita de las pruebas, etcétera.
I have criticized the increase of so-called areas or zones where rights are no longer respected, places where individuals are facing a lack of their, or experiencing a lack of their rights to their own defense, to communication.
En todo caso, lo que quería resaltar es que debe lucharse frente al terrorismo estrictamente desde la legalidad, porque si se traspasa esa línea que divide la legalidad y la ilegalidad, es mucho peor, puesto que el gobierno o los que tenemos la obligación de aplicar la ley, la incumplimos y se genera una situación terrible y de auténtica criminalidad.
What I want to underline is that the fight against terrorism should be fought within legal frameworks, because if not, the line between legality and illegal methods of fighting terrorism becomes blurred, and we as investigators and as judges can no longer comply with our responsibilities.
Well, on that note, we're going to close this segment. I want to thank Judge Baltasar Garzón of Spain, Jennifer Harbury, and Joyce Horman for being with us. Those of you who are in the New York area listening to this show can hear them this afternoon, where they'll be a part of the Historical Memory Project Conference at John Jay College of Criminal Justice on 58th and 10th Avenue, I think it is. And they'll be there this afternoon. The conference is going on all day. Thank you very much for being with us. And when we come back, we're going to go to the situation in Venezuela. You're listening to Democracy Now! Welcome back to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez. Saturday marks the one-month anniversary of the failed ouster of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. This weekend, the streets of Caracas will be full of Chavez supporters and opponents. A truth commission and congressional panel has begun investigating claims of a vast conspiracy to topple him, possibly with U.S. support. Washington has denied any role in the coup, but in the past year, the United States channeled hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants to American and Venezuelan groups opposed to President Chavez. After the president criticized U.S. bombing of Afghanistan as, quote, fighting terrorism with terrorism, and calling it the, quote, slaughter of innocents, the United States called its ambassador back to Washington for consultations. Venezuela has the largest petroleum reserves outside the Middle East. But since the populist Chavez won a landslide victory 4 years ago, Venezuela has become something of a socialist experiment. Since taking office, Chavez has ratified a new constitution, quadrupled spending on health care, and launched a massive public works program. He has brought Venezuela closer to Fidel Castro, which has clearly antagonized Washington. He has sharply criticized the policies of savage neoliberalism imposed on Latin America by the United States. He has even withdrawn the Venezuelan military from regional naval exercises in the Caribbean and denied the U.S. military access to Venezuelan airspace, hampering Washington's war in Colombia, again, its so-called drug war. Today, we're going to talk with some Venezuelan officials who are in New York for the United Nations Conference on the Child and also in Venezuela. And we're going to get the other point of view. We've been hearing a lot about from the U.S. press about the U.S. government point of view, and but it's time to hear some from the Venezuelan government officials themselves about the situation. And so we're joined in the studio by Marelis Perez, who is a representative of the Venezuelan legislature. Her work is in the area of women, children, and the family. We're also joined by telephone from Caracas, by Gilberto Buenaño, the Vice Minister of Regional Planning for the Venezuelan government. And also here with us in the studio is Carol Delgado, of the Global Justice Foundation, an NGO in Venezuela. She is in New York also at the UN Conference on the Child with the official Venezuelan delegation. And I'd like to begin with Marelis Perez. Welcome to Democracy Now! And if you could tell us a little bit in terms of what have been some of the actual social changes that the Chavez government has brought about in Venezuelan society. Si nos puede decir un poco de los cambios sociales que el gobierno del presidente Chávez ha traído al pueblo venezolano.
Muy buenos días y muchísimas gracias por esta oportunidad que nos dan de plantear ante el pueblo norteamericano la situación de nuestro país, y gracias a los radioescuchas que se quedan con nosotros para escuchar los planteamientos que le vamos a hacer. Y permítame decirle que si algo requiere hoy el pueblo de Venezuela es de la comprensión de los pueblos de nuestra América. Efectivamente.
Good day, and thank you for this opportunity for telling the American public or explaining to the American public what is going on in Venezuela today. If it's one thing that Venezuela needs, it's understanding on behalf of the American public.
Podemos decir que lamentamos muchísimo, bueno, la actual situación de crisis política en que se desenvuelve el país, porque efectivamente el gobierno nacional venía avanzando en una política de apoyo, de resolución de problemas sociales sumamente importante.
We lament the current political crisis because recently the government has been experiencing an advance in public support with its conflict resolution.
El año pasado, antes de la huelga empresarial, ya indicadores nos señalaban de que efectivamente los índices de desempleo habían bajado en casi 4 puntos y habíamos logrado niveles importantes de control de la inflación.
Last year, before the labor strike, indices demonstrated that national unemployment had decreased by 4% and that inflation had actually begun to decrease as well.
Asimismo, se había logrado una reforma importante de la reglamentación bancaria que posibilitó crear el sistema de microfinanciamiento para que el pueblo más pobre de escasos recursos pudiera accesar a créditos.
At the same time, an important banking resolution was created so that permitted microfinancing. This permitted poor individuals or people who lived in poorer neighborhoods to obtain financing to begin their own businesses.
Se le ha venido dando un fortalecimiento de política nacional al sistema de cooperativa y de microempresa, ¿verdad?, con la cual se puede organizar a esa amplia mayoría del pueblo que quedó fuera del sistema productivo, incorporarlo al trabajo y a la producción.
There has been a strengthening in the participation of micro businesses, and there's also been an opening in the spaces for these small businesses to participate in national government and national discourse.
Asimismo, se creó el Banco de la Mujer y el Banco del Pueblo, y se logró que el sistema del fondo de financiamiento a la agricultura y a la pesca se pudieran convertir en sistema de apoyo a los sectores pobres del país.
Because of this opening in the banking laws, the Bank of the Woman and the Bank of the Pueblo, the small village, were also created. This allowed for the agricultural industry and the fishing industry to receive greater support on behalf of the government.
Y se mejoraron los salarios en los tres desde que el presidente Chávez llegó al poder. Sistemáticamente, el primero de mayo, un 10% ha venido, incluso este año fue del 20%, mejorando el salario de las masas trabajadoras.
Salaries have also improved for the working class. Since Hugo Chavez assumed power, every May 10th, salaries immediately increased 10%.
Y eso no es populismo, es política social de apoyo a los más pobres.
And that's not populism, that's social politics, that's supporting the lower and the poorer class, the working class.
I'd like to bring into the conversation who's with us by telephone from Caracas, Gilberto Buenaño, who's the Vice Minister of Regional Planning for the Venezuelan government. And I'd like to ask if you could continue talking with us as Marelis Perez has about the social reforms of the Chavez government, of your government, specifically, for instance, in the areas of education. And one reform that I know has caused a lot of unrest among the upper classes of Venezuela, the land reform policies of the government.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting us to this to participate in this program. As Marelis said, we really appreciate this opportunity because in this the treatment that the news media has given to us here in Venezuela has been so bad that we haven't been able to put through our view of what is going on in Venezuela. So we really appreciate, and we especially this opportunity is very important because American people must know also what is going on in Venezuela through independent sources and through direct information. So what is important to mention here to begin with is that we in Venezuela have been conducting a pacific and democratic process in which the participation of the population has been in the first place. President Chavez won the election in a public, in a national context in the year 1998. It was a democratic election. It won the election by a majority. And after that, he proposed to Venezuelan people the possibility of having a new constitution, and the Venezuelan population accepted that proposal and voted massively for a new constitution, not only to decide if we wanted or not to have a new constitution, but also for the result, the outcome of the National Assembly, who discussed around the whole country every single proposal for the new constitution. As a result of that, we have the most democratic process to decide, not only for the president that we now have, but also for the constitution that we now have. It was not only one, but seven election processes through which we Venezuelans gave ourselves a new constitution and new authorities, because President Chavez also proposed to vote again for all the authorities in Venezuela, and he was elected again as a president. So the first point that I want to make is that this is a pacific and a democratic process, and it's the outcome of the will of the Venezuelan population, the majority of the Venezuelan population. Nevertheless, we have to say that we had a lot of problems that we could resume in different aspects, in the environmental, social, territorial, economic, and international problems, to which we decided to prepare a government program to give answer to all these problems.
Well, I'd like to also ask Carol Delgado, who is here with us, from the Global Justice Foundation, to talk about, you're here for the UN conference on the child. What has been the impact of the Chavez, democratic revolution on children in Venezuela?
Actually, we just adjust the legislation to the Convention of Children's Rights, and we're kind of implementing, but the main achievements had to do with education. There is over a million of children who were excluded to education, and they are now participating, and also the investment on education grow from 2.8 of the gross national product to 7%. That's that's something important, and it's not only investment in salaries, as is the case in other Latin American countries, but it's investment in food. There are many Bolivarian schools. There are 650,000 children who benefit from these kind of schools that provide breakfast, provide lunch, and also provide a snack in the afternoon. That's very important, because guarantee education is also being able to guarantee food. But I wanted to add to what Gilberto Buenaño and Marelli said, that the land redistribution is a very important process, and that's taking place both in rural and urban places, and that the poorest in Venezuela are very interested in this revolution. And I think that's something that Nicaraguan revolution failed to do. And if we can do it in Venezuela, we're going to make possible that that people, finally overcome social exclusion. And then I would like to talk a little bit more about the coup.
Go ahead. If you want to talk about the coup, yes.
Okay. I think the coup, we have a constitution that set the channels. If we don't like a government, if we feel that we're not represented by that government, we have the channels to ask for a referendum and say that we want a different president and then call elections. And the coup is something really, really dangerous, because this is actually a coup, is a warning not only to Venezuela, it's a warning to all American, Latin American countries and countries, third countries of the world, because it seems that this coup had a lot to do with the policies of President Chavez, and he's, you know, he's criticizing globalization, opposing the ultra-liberal model. And I think I want to call for international solidarity, because it's very important that the international community plays a key role in here, because right now it's not only protecting Venezuelan democracy, but protecting international democracy.
Well, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time, and we do have to make one other give some other information, which has to do with the Brazilian Workers' Party candidate for president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who's leading in the polls, but the Workers' Party has been organizing with increasing success on the local level since the ending of the dictatorship, and there is some important information about a protest relating to that that we want to talk right now, and we have someone who's going to give us a little information.
Hi, Juan. Yes, my name is Paulo Nunes Bueno. I'm from New Yorkers for Lula. And very briefly, what's happening is that Lula is leading very, very large margins in the polls. And unfortunately, the response of the world markets has been that they've downgraded their recommendations for investments in the Brazilian economy, which has had an incredible impact in the Brazil's economy just in the last 2 weeks. The markets have gone into a tailspin. The currency has devaluated. And so we New Yorkers who hope for a progressive presidency in Brazil, who love Lula, have a good-humored protest today in front of Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, which is at 48th and Broadway. We're going to have some samba, we're going to have some capoeira, and we really need all the BAI listeners to come out and give some support and tell the big financial institutions that they can't meddle in these Latin American, they can't meddle in democracies in other countries in this way. So we really appreciate you being there.
Okay, and I think on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up for today's program. It's been a chock-full program. I want to thank Marelis Perez, the representative of the Venezuelan legislature, and Carol Delgado from the Global Justice Foundation, an NGO in Venezuela, both of whom are here for the UN Conference on the Child. And I also want to thank Gilberto Buenaño, Vice Minister of Regional Planning for the Chavez government, who's speaking with us by phone from Caracas. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. I want to thank Michelle Wanke for the translations for our guests. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org, and you can email us at mail@democracy.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez, filling in for Amy Goodman, who's en route to East Timor. Listen to her next week. Starting next week, Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from East Timor. Thanks for listening.